From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It always strikes me as interesting how small the world gets. If you are a fan of the great, the halcyon days of MTV animation, you may know a show called Clone High. We ran that great period with Syphil and Ollie and all these shows mm-hmm. that you just had to watch. You couldn't just watch an episode. You had to watch many episodes to really get into it. My guest today, Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who of course did the Lego movie, did one of the greatest shows in the history of animation, Clone High. They also did Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, 21 Jump Street, and 22 Jump Street is coming up. But guys, I loved that show so much. And
wow.
I always connect that in Syphil and Ollie. And Liam Lunch worked on both, right?
That's right.
Yeah, that's right.
Liam did the songs for Clone High, and he was a very talented and funny guy.
And do me a favor, because
yes, I'll explain to
no
what the heck
has
was.
Ever seen no. this show except the three yeah. people in this room.
So we made this show many years ago on MTV called Clone High, and it was about clones of historical figures who go to high school together and date. So it was Abraham Lincoln and Gandhi and Joan of Arc and JFK and Cleopatra, and they all had angst
and special appearances
issues.
By Genghis Khan.
Yes,
exactly.
Everybody, Sigmund Freud, everybody was in that show. But, you know, for example, the show kind of got into trouble and was canceled because the Gandhi character was
G-Man. We
yeah, the G-Man. Yeah,
he was. The idea there was that, you know, he had so much pressure to live up to the original Gandhi. He knew that he was a clone of Gandhi, and if you knew that that was what you were supposed to become, the kind of pressure would be very crippling. And then we thought that he decided to just go the other way and be a party guy.
It's funny because that character predates Kumar and Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
And it was based on, we both went to different high schools, but we both knew kids like that of Indian descent who had a lot of pressure from their parents and high expectations, but also wanted to be socially really popular and just kind of went the other way after a while. Once I had a friend who got into MIT and then, like, early admission, and then went crazy. Just like he was drinking all the time and did everything he could to get kicked out.
But the politicians in India were not super excited
about. Is
that
true? Is that what happened? Because there was
Gandhi's super famous there, I guess?
Where? What is this mythical country in which he's famous?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because it's almost, if you think back to the first section of the Gandhi movie with Ben Kingsley, he's kind of like a...
Well, when we did the research on him, you know, before he sort of... He was a lawyer in South Africa, and he was kind of a party guy, and he was a socialite, and he
still
told jokes
around himself
with
women
guy.
To test his celibacy.
Yes, dubious. So we basically, you know, we thought we were being consistent, you know, with the story of that person, what it would feel like to know that you were supposed to grow up to be that guy. We didn't.
Yeah,
that nuance was lost on hunger strikers in India.
Yeah, there was a hunger strike, and the show was taken off the air. Yes.
There's a hunger strike, and Tom Freston, who's the head of Viacom at the time, happens to be in India.
Visiting
the offices.
Oh, come on. Now you're making this up.
No, it's so horrifyingly
true. And he was trapped
in
the building, and Gandhi's grandson and 150 politicians had like a sit-in hunger strike in the building, and then the show was taken off the air.
Yeah.
My guests, who use historical extrapolation as the basis of comedy, Phil Lord and Chris Miller, the new film as directors and filmmakers, is the Lego movie. But I even think about Jonah's character in 21 Jump Street, who's like the same kind of guy who's trying to recreate this thing and sort of like builds this kind of fantasy world around himself.
Yeah, I mean, he gets a second chance at high school in that one, and he wants to do it right this time. And luckily, the world has changed for him. And he's able to fit in and get all the things that he never got the first time.
Right. The perception of what high school is supposed to be never matches up to the reality. He's even in the beginning of the movie trying to he's dressing like Eminem and trying to project us, you know, a version of himself that isn't real.
Eminem with braces.
Eminem exactly. with braces, which is so so desperate and it subverts itself.
But it's interesting too, because I feel like for you guys on some level, like the John Hughes movies with that kind of overripe melodrama about mm-hmm. being a teenager.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like lends itself to a certain amount of parody for you anyway, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's the great American mythology, right? It's the thing we all go through, and it's where it's like the furnace where everybody is made. And I think we both relate to folks who didn't have a great high school experience. We had like really pleasant high school experiences, but we were small for our age, and
where'd you guys go to high school?
I went in Seattle, and he was in Miami. So
we both went to prissy private schools.
Yeah. Oh,
where? But I was like the one car in the parking lot that was the hand-me-down car. Everyone else got like a brand new Beamer. Or it was Miami, so it was like a white Jeep Cherokee was like the coolest car. And then...
Well, I was in Seattle where it was during the grunge period, so everybody had like a beat up Volvo.
Oh, and you were like the one sad kid with a brand new Mercedes?
No, I was driving a real nice Toyota Camry.
Oh, very nice. Oh,
so yeah, like still, the least sexy car in the world. Your car was way too efficient.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's so sensible and
exactly.
safe.
Exactly.
I know.
But this is so interesting because for you guys, you so often make fun of morality. I mean, mm-hmm. the institution morality. I mean, mm-hmm. it's been a part of everything that you've done. You talk about having pretty pleasant high school experiences, but still you must have been amused by the fact that people, even in high school, I mean, these cliques are in fact institutions on their own.
Yes.
And the sort of the worldwide clique in the Lego movie.
Yes, I think we grew up questioning institutions. I think
definitely
the case.
And also the need to belong is something that you guys seem to look at with a jaundiced eye.
Yes.
Yeah, I think there's sort of, because we grew up very small, both of us were, you know, under 5 feet when we started high school and we were the smallest
so
kids
was
in
I,
our
so
class.
I know what that's like. I would skip a couple
grades. And so like
grades,
this, so, yeah. you know, it sort of developed our comedic sense to get attention, and we just wanted people to notice us, and we had very similar childhoods.
It was also, you know, it was before the internet, so how you appeared physically was even more important, and there was no such thing as like a cool nerd. Like Andy Samberg didn't exist. Like you couldn't go online and make a funny video and have girls like you. It, you know, it was about like your performance on an athletic field or something. You were really compromised if you were smaller. And I think Chris and I both, I don't know, you know, Chris was like a child genius. And I went to a public school where some of the teaching wasn't so great. And we've both felt alienated on some level by feeling like intellectuals, you know, or curious people that were not among other curious people. So there was this need to relate to everybody and want to fit in socially while at the same time feeling apart from everybody. And I think Flint Lockwood is a very literal example of someone who's a gifted child in a small town and doesn't have anyone else to relate to. And
character from Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Yeah.
The protagonist yes. from Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Exactly.
A lot of our characters, I think, have some relationship to that feeling.
Yeah, yearning for acceptance.
And there's this... The tone in the films, each is sort of like saying, you guys shouldn't want to do this. I mean, and I wonder how you guys arrive at that tone when you're using the context to almost judge the characters for wanting to be these things.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we like to have it both ways, always. You know, we like, we sort of protect ourselves that way because it seems a little too trite usually to say, make a really strong point in one way and then without sort of critiquing the other side as well. So we really take a lot of care.
It might have something to do with the fact that there's two of us.
Yeah,
our always. Relationship is already a dialectic, so a lot of our movies are sort of that way.
Well, don't forget the other side.
Yeah, our movies are just long arguments.
But they really are, because, I mean, you take these movies, and in terms of this is something almost a kind of a melodramatic dilemma that the protagonists have in terms of wanting to belong to something.
Mm-hmm.
And movies are still made in which that, you know, there wouldn't be a young adult fiction.
Yes.
if that context didn't still exist and wasn't still profitable. But I think you must have arrived early as kids even at the decision that, well, I guess I want to belong, but why do I want to belong?
Yeah,
to this?
We have like a conflicted feeling about that because that's like a human impulse, right? It's life or death. I had a shrink tell me that once. I was like, why am I so nervous socially?
A shrink told you it was
a shrink, yeah. And he was like,
a Freudian, I'm suspecting, right?
This very smart psychologist, my mom is a psychologist, and she was like, you're really anxious. You should see this guy. I'm a huge fan of his. And I looked him up and sat down with him, and he said, one of the reasons is that people are so desperate to fit in is it's life or death. If you're a cave person and you don't fit into that tribe, you freeze to death or you starve to death. And there's something in our bodies that can't forget that, no matter how untrue that is. And now we live in a world where actually you'll be fine. You know, you can feed yourself, you'll survive. And so we can now afford to question that stuff. And it does seem ridiculous. And some of our characters realize that that yearning isn't completely right and it's getting in their way. You know, Flint Lockwood's, that's a the moral of that is that he was so desperate to fit in and have people like him that it tripped him up and it, you know, it almost destroyed the universe.
But the guys who do fit in, and we can look at Channing and 21 Jump Street or almost anybody in Clone High or the Lego movie, they're kind of idiots if they fit in.
Well, yeah, there's something about sort of the mob mentality of the pack that is funny in comedy. And I think that that's the other side of the coin is that you really want to fit into to society, but what is the society that you want to fit into? And in the case of the Lego movie, you've got a guy who really just wants to, like, be part of this world where everybody's following the instructions but needs to free himself of that. And once he learns that he has to, like, go his own path and create his own stuff, we go down that road of wanting, like, boundless creativity. But then two-thirds of the way through the movie, we also say, well, actually, following the instructions is can be good. It's nice to have a plan every once in a while. Like if it's just wild creativity, it sometimes doesn't work.
Yeah, either. There has to be social accountability on some level or the whole thing will fall apart.
Yeah, I mean, again, to these, you said dialect, the movies do sort of like set these kind of dueling philosophies. I'm sorry, these warring philosophies.
Yes.
And it just, again, if anybody else, I mean, you know, this, we're talking about Chekhov here. You know, I mean, you could definitely go in another direction with it, but clearly it comes out of you guys. I'm guessing being smaller guys when you were in school, and I did this too, you use comedy as a coping device.
Totally.
Absolutely.
To get chicks. You know,
now
that was like the main impulse at that point.
How did that work?
It failed utterly. It took like 20 years for that to work.
But I mean, but that still though, there's something about enthusiasm that you guys like me because each of these these iterations that you've done, there's been the characters are wildly sort of passionate. Maybe that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, I mean, nobody wants to watch a character that's lethargic and doesn't care. If you know,
do you ever watch the CW? They're all lethargic. <don't care. laughs>
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, I guess not nobody, but not me. yeah. There's something so endearing about passion.
Yeah, but that unchecked youthful passion. I mean, it really is a sort of you're almost running into doors, which it's almost like a living pratfall in some ways.
Yeah, that whole person is a banana peel.
Yeah,
they're constantly running and slipping and falling on themselves.
It's kind of coincidental that his name is Chris Pratt. I mean,
it's true.
Considering
that's the exact reason we cast him.
Yeah, exactly.
We have never heard of him.
Yeah.
I was like, Pratt, that's a funny name. He's hired.
We'll take a break as we get a little bit too epistemological here. My guests, who are directors of the Crazy Lego Movie, are Phil Lord and Chris Miller. So treatment this morning. Come stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
Welcome back. We're way too philosophical in talking about the Lego movies with its creators, Phil Lord and Chris Miller. It's The Treatment. But I just find myself thinking, too, I mean, so much of this, and I wonder, in terms of the writing of these things you're doing, you could step into melodrama and even the Lego movie, it does get dramatic at one point in the real world. I don't want to give too much away because I think people should see it, but I wonder how you arrive at those points where you have to veer away from drama and in the Lego movie you decided to really step into it.
Well, we talk a lot about opera and that sometimes these, especially in animation, but we do it in Jump Street too. We want things to be that bold and that big and that emotional, and it's sometimes really challenging to get that level of feeling into stuff. And maybe we overdo it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had a while ago, you know, when we did Clone High, we were sort of making fun of over-emotional, angsty teen shows. And so
oh, my God, Dawson's Creek.
Yes,
it's unbelievable.
Exactly. And then we did Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, where our first versions of that was just joke. It was like Airplane. But there wasn't a lot of heart or emotion in it. And people were kind of squirming in their seats. They were laughing a lot when we would show them animatics, early cuts of the movie.
And it was each 20 minutes of it was hilarious, and the whole thing was boring.
It must have been exhausting after a while.
It was exhausting. Yeah.
And Amy Pascal was the head of Sony Pictures. She's like, I'm not feeling anything. You got to give me some more heart. And we were so angry and frustrated going like, come on, it's funny. And then we sat down and we really like worked on making you care and really giving like we added this the father-son story to that storyline and really tried hard to give it a lot of real heightened emotion.
Spent like a year doing that.
Yeah.
And it made the movie so much funnier. That's what was surprising.
And so that's when we like learned that it's so much better. The more emotion you can pack into the thing, the funnier it actually gets. And so that we really didn't shy away from it in the Lego movie, especially towards the end, as you mentioned, where it really like turns really emotional. And I think that only helps you fall in love with it more.
I guess I find myself thinking that, you know, there's something about Lego that when you look at the boxes, you want them to come to life anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about the almost so many of the tableaus, I mean, the explosions and the rippling waves that look like they were right off Lego boxes. That's kind of fun to watch, too.
Something that we were insisting on from the beginning was that everything in this movie was going to be made of Lego, including the oceans and explosions and fire and clouds and smoke. And everybody looked at us like we were crazy. But that's what sort of makes you want to go to the movies, is seeing something you've never seen before.
I love how Lego is a good example of the power of human beings to project character and narrative onto inanimate objects. And so part of what inspired us the whole time, and one of the reasons I think we intuitively wanted to do explosions out of Lego bricks, and why I think I like the shots in the film that are made of the fewest, biggest bricks, you know, that are the most macro, is that feeling of taking something that has, you know, 5 points of articulation and somehow projecting a personality onto it and projecting an explosion onto just like weird assemblage of squares.
Yeah, it's all iconography, right? You have to represent, you know, Batman in, you know, in an inch and a half tall being. And so it has to be stripped down of everything except for its most essential elements. And even if you're like making a coffee shop out of Lego, you're like, what are the iconic things about a coffee shop and how can we represent it with bricks?
That coffee shop is almost like, yeah. it's so weird because it's like a Starbucks that's also like Nighthawks at the Diner.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of that.
No, it's a lot of that. But I mean, you talked about that whole Batman thing as a comic geek. I have to say there's this great conflation where he's both Frank Miller's Dark Knight and Adam West Batman.
Yeah. It's true.
The weird center of that very small Venn diagram.
There's one thing there, and it's Will Arnett's voice.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, again, just the whole Green Lantern, Superman argument and the invisible plane. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I thrilled when I saw it.
When you didn't see the invisible plane.
It was very nice of the nice people at Warner's in D.C. to let us have a little fun with the...
And foolhardy.
You know, yeah. They were maybe asleep at the switch.
Yeah.
Because you're right. They're generally so protective. Batman doesn't do this.
Yeah.
Batman is not Lego. Batman is Batman now. But it's still
the
Batman costume from the 1989 movie. So still, it's like it's so many different kinds
yeah,
of
Yeah, we did. We wanted it. Yeah, exactly.
But what he has in common is he's rich and he's a badass and he's kind of brooding and dark.
And it gives a great song to explain that to us in case you somehow missed the point.
And he's super self-centered for someone who's saving the world.
Yeah, we thought, you know, it came about because, you know, we wanted Emmett, the main character, is in love with this woman, Wildstyle, played by Elizabeth Banks, and we wanted her to have a boyfriend and to have that sort of
classic triangle. I mean, just the
triangle.
Idea of a Lego boyfriend, too. I mean, that's a whole other thing.
That is crazy, yeah. But we're like, who would be the person... that if the girl you liked was dating would be the hardest person to ever have be their boyfriend. Like, well, if the girl you liked was dating Batman, you're screwed.
Yeah.
Because that guy is like
wealthy.
Cool. He's wealthy. He's like
works out all the time.
He's like that the boyfriend. He's like, oh, you don't know. He's had a tortured past. He's, you know, he's not like that when you're not around. I can change him.
Batman might be the ultimate expression of white male teen angst.
Right.
You know, he's like...
Yes, because in addition to everything else, is also that kind of operatic self-pity.
Exactly.
Yeah, like, oh, I'm a rich, incredibly successful, incredibly powerful,
incredibly handsome,
handsome,
white person. I don't know about my purpose in life.
My parents died. I'm an orphan, so I had to build a plane. And since
everyone's parents die eventually. Your problem is that, like, even though you have everything anyone else in the world wants, you don't feel fulfilled anymore.
Well, my guests would just explain to me why I'm so threatened by white men are Phil Lord and Chris Miller. They're the directors of the Lego movie. It's the treatment. But there's a thing that you guys do that you sort of like take the surreal and bend it into the real. I mean, because the idea, even in your live action, like Twenty on Jump Street, there's no way in the world anybody, unless you were like making Porky's, in which the guys are in their 30s still in high school, that you would believe, that remotely believe these guys are still in high school.
Well, get ready for 22 Jump Street.
They're even older looking.
And they somehow look like they're 50.
But the surreal is something that clearly tickles you to work with, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. And taking it seriously.
Yes, exactly.
What is interesting to us is starting with an absurd premise and then say, okay, well, what would it really be like to be the clone of Abraham Lincoln? How would you feel? How would people react to you? You know, what, with Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, like how did food start to rain from the sky? And that's where we came up with the Fladznifredover, the craziest machine ever, because we wanted to think of some, you know, baloney reason why, you know, why that could be real.
But I also love, even in Cloudy, Mr. T's character, who is a dad who's passionately, insanely in love with his son.
Yeah.
So much so that his son is embarrassed by it. Come on, Dad, really? I can do this. I mean, again, that gets back to that whole thing I'm saying. You talked about opera, and opera is taking the real and sort of pushing it until it's slightly surreal. Not slightly, until it's absurd.
Yeah.
Because there's so much emotion invested in it.
Yeah, that's right.
Everything's the most important thing in the world.
And that's kind of central to all your movies, that everything is the most important thing in the world. And so often, almost always, as a matter of fact, that emotional investment is played for drama.
Right. And that's what's funny about it.
That's where
the jokes come from. Yeah, you need something for that stuff to play against. The highest stakes possible. And it's not enough for the stakes to be kind of movie stakes, like the world's going to explode. It has to be
personal.
Big personal emotional stakes.
Because in a Lego movie, it's the one time you don't play the melodrama moment for laughs. I mean, because in Cloudy, it is funny and dramatic at the same time.
Exactly.
But you don't do that. And I wondered where that decision came from, to sort of play it as straight as possible.
We were uncomfortable
it's very
with that for a really long time.
Yeah.
It's going to be schmaltzy.
We feel more secure when we're doing a joke at the same time.
Undercut it somehow.
At the end of Cloudy, the big emotional moment is James Caan's character, Flint Lockwood's dad, you know, telling Bill Hader's character how much he loves him, but he's doing it through a monkey thought translator that's just where all the jokes have come out of. And so it's crazy and sweet at the same time. And this one was sort of just sweet, and we just weren't sure if it was ever going to work.
Not only that, but you're playing it with a character, an actor, I'm not going to give too much away, who we look to for comedy.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, and I think he's a great actor, and I don't know. It was maybe we just so earnestly believed in that message, you know, that's what had to happen.
Yeah. I'm not even sure why we didn't.
So you're like making us discover something about the movie that we knew in our bodies, but I don't think we'd thought about in our frontal lobe very much, you know, why that, you know, it is like the one place where we're okay.
Not having a laugh.
Not undercutting it with a big joke. Yeah.
What was that like to direct those sequences? Because again, the actor we're talking about, Will Forte, is somebody who, in playing these comic characters, over-invests them in terms of passion and emotion.
Yes. Yeah. It was scary.
Yeah,
it was totally scary.
Because Chris is not...
Yeah. Oh, he's not as scared. I was scared.
No,
Chris was super confident,
apparently. Oh, absolutely. No, I was terrified. You know, it was definitely a big risk. We don't want to spoil it again, but there is obviously a big twist and a big change of the whole paradigm in the movie in the last act. And there definitely was a lot of worry from everyone. Is this going to work? Is this going to like fit together as a film? And it was so integral to our original concept of the movie. We were confident that it could work, but we weren't confident that it would work.
So it was always there. It was always part of the building blocks.
It was always part of the...
Yes. Definitely. And maybe it's that the rest of the movie and where the rest of the movie takes place is such a world of surreality that you needed to get really grounded at the very end for a second, that felt satisfying to suddenly say, no, this is about something really genuine and earnest and heartfelt.
And real. And universal.
And so much so that you're playing and unlike all the other places in movies, because of the really big rooms and almost all the interiors in Jump Street are really big sort of set piece kind of things.
Get ready for 22.
Even bigger, well, because bigger is better. Yeah.
That's what I keep hearing. But in this climactic moment, it's played in a very intimate space, which is even a very different thing than you guys have done before, too. And mm-hmm. I'm curious about the kind of directing choreography and sort of building that set and talking about that a little bit.
Well, we should have made it a little bigger for the cameras. That's one thing we figured out.
Oh, that's too late.
But I feel like what was interesting about the Lego movie is that you're dealing with these tiny little characters. And
that are almost always smiling, by the way, which is yes, another part of directing something like that, too.
Yeah.
And part of the fun of that was like to try and take the tiniest thing and make it into the biggest thing in the world, right? Like big grand vistas and huge action scenes
on a tiny little scale. Stuff you couldn't possibly build in real life. Like that pirate ship, it's like 100,000 pieces or something like that.
Or the pirate.
Or the pirate is to everything was like we need it to be bigger and bigger and bigger.
But then what ended up being kind of funny is to contrast that with like really small and intimate moments. And some of our favorite moments besides seeing a Lego ocean undulate out of Lego bricks, which is a really cinematic feeling, is like there's an intimate scene between Emmett and Wildstyle in this sort of little tunnel grate where it's just a small intimate moment between these two characters. And it's in a very confined space, and you're really paying attention to the subtlety of their acting. And the animators did a very nice job of the subtlety of that. And the contrast between that and the other extreme was kind of fun for us.
And also in the eyes of a kid, their bedroom is a universe. And I think that's why the movie wants to get small at the very end. Also, that thing that we have a friend, Lindsay Duran, that
oh, sure.
works on our movies with us a lot.
Oh, God, sure.
And she's a genius, and she says most, even big movies, a lot of them end with two people sitting at a table. You know, like The Avengers.
Yeah, or even Toy Story, which ends with Woody and Buzz. It's like a John Formo. This is just the two of them talking.
That's right, and there's something about that, and I think that's really consistent. The relationship is what the movie's really about. The plot is about
saving the universe. Or whatever, but it's really about a relationship.
The story is about those two people. And until you have that scene, people don't feel satisfied.
Well, I think they're going to be extremely satisfied. They already are. The movie's a big hit. I can't thank you guys enough for doing this.
Oh my gosh, it's so fun. It's a dream come
true. It's a real pleasure to meet you.
Really? Such small dreams, given how big their character's dream is.
Achievable goals.
That's what we're trying to do.
Yes, one step at a time. My guests are the directors of the Lego movie, Phil Lord and Chris Miller. It's the treatment, our recording engineer. Welcome back. As J.C. Swag, this show is mixed by Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Rattlett. Everything is awesome. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's the treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.